Pope John Paul II wrote in the prologue to his encyclical called Fides et Ratio that, quote, faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit rises to the contemplation of truth. And God has placed in the human heart a desire to know the truth, in a word, to know himself, so that by knowing and loving God, men and women may also come to the fullness of truth about themselves, end quote. When I first read this, I thought of our speaker, John Huntington, whom we are blessed to have with us this evening. John is going to give us a deeply personal look at how his love of the truth led him to the love of God and ultimately to the Catholic Church in 2012. If you don't know already, John is our new director of Adult RCIA at St. Peter's. He's also a guest columnist for our diocesan newspaper, and I think this was his first article in December of 2013. He looks a little bit different here in this picture. but very handsome, yes, just as handsome. And that came from his wife, Judy, right here. Welcome, Judy. They're the parents of six grown children. How many grandchildren do you guys have? Okay, 12 plus grandchildren. That's wonderful. So we welcome you tonight as well. Please welcome our speaker, Mr. John Huntington.
It is said that man tends by nature toward the truth. I experience this as a love affair. The love of truth impels the scientist to pursue discoveries about nature, just as it impels the mystic to contemplate the mysteries of the faith. While the scientist perceives aspects of nature, the mystic experiences divine love, and all of this from a single source. So to me, love and truth always belong together. Grateful to you for asking me to speak about my intellectual and spiritual journey into the Catholic Church tonight. I want to do this with clarity and accuracy so that you can safely judge for yourselves how to receive what I have to say. I want to equip you with some thoughts that might be fresh and helpful to you. And I confess at the outset that my purpose is pastoral. It is to comfort and bring hope to everyone that I encounter. I speak from within the Catholic faith, from within the mind of a physical scientist, and from within a pastoral heart. This is not to say that I have any agenda of my own. I have only the one agenda given all of us by the gospel of Christ. Speak to you this evening about my interior life without embarrassment. You may be embarrassed, but I may not. I'm not permitted. I will speak about my vocation as a physical scientist, my vocation to the priesthood, my way of reconciling science and faith, my two vocations, and my personal reconciliation with Rome. Because we must do this in approximately an hour, maybe an hour and a quarter, I ask you to put on your seven-league boots. We're going to be covering a great deal of material in a very short time. I really do hope for a good discussion following. In order to get this done, I ask you to write your questions down immediately when they occur to you on these index cards so that we don't lose them. Afterwards, I will do my best to address them here and we will have a discussion, but I promise you I will address every one of them fully in written form after we're done here, when I'm in the peace of my study and I can look at these questions carefully. So they will be answered fully in writing. We will post them on the web for you to read. My vocation to physical science was not something that I had fully expected. It was a bit of a surprise to me that came as a future that opened to me in my junior year in high school. I had a most wonderful physics teacher named Harvey Pollack, whose manner of briefing and teaching was just right for me. Everything he said seemed so very clear. I seemed to get it at once. He noticed me because I got 100% on every examination, and I got perfect scores on all of the extra credit problems, you know, describe how this thing works, and he would plunge a self-starting siphon into a bucket of water, and you had to look at it and figure the physics out and write it up. So I had perfect scores in everything, and he noticed me. I was walking to school one day. We were across Flushing Meadow from Forest Hills High School. We lived over on the Flushing side. And he passed me in his car and stopped and offered me a ride. And while we were riding to school, maybe 15 minutes, he posed a problem to me. He said, John, if you were in an airplane, you were in the clouds, and you didn't have any contact with the ground, how would you know where you were? And I said, well, if you had a radar, you could see some ground objects, and you could... Yet someone said, no, you can't do that. So what he was trying to do was to get me in 15 minutes to invent inertial navigation. Well, I disappointed him. I didn't come up with inertial navigation in those few minutes. But clearly he thought I was something special. And you know, when a teacher thinks that way about you, it scores with the student. The student notices that he sees himself reflected in his teacher's eyes. And this gave me a new direction in my life, that physical science was something that I could turn toward with happily and with confidence. I was at the time having a very good experience with mathematics. And so I had this pivotal moment in my junior year in high school. In college, I rebelled against my father in a way that might raise some eyebrows, because it seems like such a little thing, perhaps. I changed my major from chemical engineering to chemistry. This was my great rebellion. And the thing is that I really, at the time, didn't know how big a change that was. Not to speak disparagingly of engineering, but science is a very different character to it. Because in science, you're always working at the fringe of what's known. Engineering depends upon established science and technology that can be used in productive work, and so it's much more practical in its orientation. But what happened was that because I changed my major to chemistry, I again in my junior year in college, in physical chemistry, boy, my chimes were rung. We studied many different aspects of chemistry that one could treat with in quantitative mathematical ways. I mean, thermodynamics and chemical kinetics and so on. But all of these things, to me, were just very, very exciting. And so in my junior year, I did something which is, again, going to sound perfectly crazy. I decided that what I wanted to do in graduate school was to apply the methods of mathematical physics to problems in chemistry. Well, why on earth would I do that? I understood something came to me that seemed to me very profound and very general in its nature. And that is, to the degree that the methods of mathematical physics and physical science itself can penetrate into other sciences, they become more sound and more truly themselves physical sciences. You know, for example, quantum mechanics explains the chemical bond and therefore all of chemistry. Well, we didn't know quantum mechanics before 1927, but it gives you the idea that right now we have molecular genetics. You see, we have quantitative physical methods telling us something about the human genome. So we have the methods of physical science penetrating into these other fields of science, and that's what my excitement was all about. So in the fall of my senior year as a chemistry major, I was at the University of Iowa at that point, I borrowed my uncle's car and drove 180 miles to Madison, Wisconsin, because they had a very famous physical chemistry department, and that seemed like the place I really ought to go. And I burst into the chemistry department and started waving my arms at this poor secretary, saying, I wanted to apply the methods of mathematical physics to problems in chemistry. And she quickly steered me to this young Professor Cornwell, a young man with a crew cut and a bow tie, very nice, well-turned-out young professor that was there to deal with people like me. And he listened for a moment, and he said, you want to talk to Professor Hirschfelder, whose name I had never heard. He was talking about one of the most famous men in physical science in this country, but I didn't know about him. Hirschfelder received dual PhDs in physics and chemistry at Princeton University. Both of his PhD professors in chemistry and physics were Nobel laureates. He was the youngest physical scientist in the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos, and he now was heading up what was called the Theoretical Chemistry Institute at the University of Wisconsin. At that time, the institute building was being built, a big tower, a research facility, and he was in a temporary quarters in the old Naval Research Laboratory and tucked away in a corner of the campus. And I went down there. He had received a phone call ahead, and he had this big office. It was kind of empty and spare, and he was sitting behind his big desk. And I stood in front of his desk waving my arms, telling him about my excitement about applying the methods of mathematical physics to problems in chemistry. I had no idea. I was telling him about his life's work. This is the most famous person in that field in the United States. And I was standing there telling him about my excitement. And he then wrote me a letter accepting me as a graduate student. I had no idea how lucky I was, how lucky I was to get Hirschfelder. I went there, and I learned that to him, that even though he was a professor of chemistry, he wanted me to study mathematics and physics as a chemistry major in graduate school. I got the equivalent of a master's degree in mathematics. I took all of the physics graduate courses except particle physics that didn't particularly interest me. But this was to equip me to work productively in quantum mechanics as applied to problems in chemistry. And so in the physics department at Wisconsin is really strong, very, very good, and so was the mathematics department. And I tore up their syllabus. I took everything. And along the way, after taking all of these other lower-level graduate physics courses in classical mechanics and electrodynamics and so on, I then took the final course in quantum mechanics taught by the most astonishing young professor named Adam Binzer. He was from a Jewish family who had fled Poland to Brazil, and he had gone from there to MIT for his undergraduate and graduate work, got his PhD in physics, and was now teaching at Wisconsin. This is one of the most brilliant people I've ever encountered. And I wrote to him not too long ago and told him so. I told him that. He's now Professor Emeritus at Wisconsin. He taught a course that was so abstract, it was not even called quantum mechanics. It was called linear operator mechanics. It was a two-semester course, and it was intense, intense intellectual work, and so starkly beautiful. It was so stunningly beautiful that I was convinced that I was doing the right thing with my young life. I was in just the right place doing the right thing, even though I had no idea what I would do for a living. I was really much too impatient to teach. I had no idea at all. And I went from there with a master's degree in hand. I went to Brown University to study with Professor John Ross, a man of Hirschfelder's stature, somewhat younger, who had got his PhD in physical chemistry at MIT and was a professor at Brown. He had a laboratory filled with experimental apparatus, And I went there specifically because I wanted to do quantum mechanical scattering theory. That is, my interests had focused down on dynamical problems rather than static problems of analyzing properties of atoms and molecules that just sit there and wiggle. I wanted things that collide and where things, chemical reactions happen in these things. And because of the way these machines are set up, you can see so much of the detail that's going on in reactive molecular collisions in a good vacuum where there's nothing to scatter the particle other than the interaction they have in this little area where they can collide. And it was the perfect place to bring nuclear scattering theory to bear on problems in chemistry. And that's what that was my PhD thesis, was to explain data that had been around for a dozen years in his laboratory, in a laboratory at Harvard, and there was one or two over in the Netherlands, and there were some around the world doing this kind of work that had results for which there seemed no classical explanation. And my thesis successfully showed that what was being observed in these experiments was in fact a quantum mechanical phenomenon. Very, very satisfying for someone who had equipped himself to do this kind of work and who wanted to go out into the world as one of the world's best problem solvers. I had this very satisfying experience. And so you can see this is also a matter of excitement and love of what we learn about the world in doing this kind of thing, and a sense of great privilege getting to do it. I had no idea why Hirschfelder and Brown thought that much of me that they would take me on, that I was there at Brown University, and I spent a year at MIT studying under Aristotle and Newton, by the way. Their names are carved in the cornice above, in the corner of the great main building at MIT, and my office was right there in the basement, so I studied under them, Aristotle and Newton, and I never forgot it. I was very much aware of that there. Now, one thing I want to tell you is about what it is to be adequately careful when you have the privilege of doing this work. You're getting to do something that other people don't get to do for two reasons. One is you're given the time, somehow the resources, you're giving all of that, and you're equipped with the tools to do things that others have not had the opportunity to do. When you find something, you find it for all of them. They get to look over your shoulder, and you must be very careful not to mislead people. And so in my first quantum mechanics course from Hirschfelder, he posed a question to us. How was it that in between the years 1927 and 1929 at Harvard, Coolidge and James solved a mathematical problem, pencil on paper? They didn't have access to computers. They were doing this by hand, and they wanted to see if they could solve for the ground state energy of the H2 plus ion, two protons and one electron. So this is something that's been measured experimentally. Would Schrödinger's equation give them the right answer? And they had an approximate method of doing this, called variation theory, and they worked at this for 2 years, and they reported a number. It was a number that they certified was free of error. And how could they possibly have done this after all of that work? And to me, it seemed quite impossible. He then told us how they did it. He taught us how to do it. He gave me a problem, a test of one of his own variation methods, a problem with a known solution, and I was to use a perturbation method and compute at the eighth order term, which would be approximate, and to see how closely it compared to the true eighth order term and the exact expansion. And so I spent 4 months doing this with a ballpoint pen on paper, and I did it error-free. I started working 2 hours a day before I had to stop, and I got to where I could do this for 5 hours a day. And so I can tell you there are techniques for doing this, and I learned to respect from Hirschfelder the responsibility to be careful and accurate, and anything published by him or any of his students in a journal is going to be free of errors. This applies to other areas of our life as well. If you want a little moralizing, it's very important to honor the truth. I had a wonderful experience in finishing my thesis. John Ross, after I had been at Brown for 1 year, was asked to come to MIT to be chairman of the chemistry department. It seems that the organic chemists were very grumpy and at war with the rest of the chemistry department, and that he would maybe make peace and make everybody happy. And he's a mensch, a wonderful man, so he did that. He came there and made peace. And so I went with him because I was doing a theoretical thesis. And every afternoon, a Wednesday afternoon, that is, at 4 o'clock, I would go there and show him my work. He had a lovely big office with a Persian rug on the floor and a little anteroom where his secretary was, but there was no conference table. So I would sit on the floor, on the rug, and spread out my papers with all my mathematics. He would sit on a hassock, pour us each a little glass of sherry, and we would do quantum mechanics. I'm telling you, this is the only way quantum mechanics should be done. The afternoon light slanting in through the Venetian blinds. It was wonderful. What a fine man. He went on from there to Stanford. He's now emeritus professor at Stanford, and he's now, I think, close to 80 years old. He must be. We went to his Festschrift for his 70th, and I wrote something for that. At any rate, what do you do with a PhD like this? I had no idea. The life of a professor didn't appeal to me, putting up with students that always want you to do their work for them. And I did enough teaching as a graduate student that I knew that didn't appeal to me. And I had a little bit of Richard Feynman in me. I wanted to work fast. I wanted to solve problems and get on to the next one. And so I had this impatience. And so I went into industry. I worked for a short time in Cambridge, Mass., but I went out to California, where I was quickly made the director of the radiation physics division of a spin-off of the Livermore Lab, a company called Physics International. So I was doing underground nuclear test experiments. I had 50-some scientists working for me, most of them much older than I. We built accelerators as big as a house. And we brought Atomic Energy Commission technology to the Department of Defense. We were helping the people designing and testing and building our strategic nuclear weapons to know how they would function in a nuclear battle, what would work and what didn't work. And so I had the good fortune of having a profession that provided well for our family. All our children that wanted college got it, and all of that was really quite good. And I guess the thing that kept me always with an edge, whether it was at the dinner table with our children or in doing my work as a physical scientist, was the specific, powerful kind of objectivity that physical science possesses. You can shoot a scientist, you can break his equipment, but his observations will stand because we fully trust that if someone came along with the interest and the resources, he would build equipment that would do the same kinds of things, and he would see the same thing. That the objectivity of physical science so far transcends anybody's bias or personal desires, but is a reflection of something that's real and beyond us. That, you see, was the thing that moved me all the way through 6 years of graduate school and in my work as a physical scientist. Now I would tell you something about the spiritual adventure. I was baptized at 6 months of age in the Diocese of Gibraltar of the Church of England in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, where my father was a mining engineer, an American mining engineer for a British mining company. My three godparents were Church of England, my father's boss, Walter Page, Serbian Orthodox, my mother's best friend, Zoica Levi, and my father's, my uncle, Herman, my mother's brother, Roman Catholic. So some people believe in the branch theory of the Orthodox Church. Well, I have all three of them, thank you very much, on my baptism certificate. I was exposed to Protestantism a little bit as a child, but it was kind of desultory. But I went to school in the dusty little town of Socorro, New Mexico, where my father was developing a manganese mine during World War II. Mount Carmel School was run by Carmelite sisters in their habits. We had infinite respect for those sisters, and believe me, they knew how to teach. We suffered like hell for 6 weeks, then everyone could read. And when I got a perfect score on my math exam, I didn't make the lines straight enough, and they were made straight with a red pencil. And in second grade, I had this absolutely the most beautiful sister, Anthony Louise, absolutely beautiful woman, who clearly loved me best. And I knew that because of the way she looked at me. And she took me everywhere by my left ear. So it was really clear. So, and of course, I took, even though I was an Anglican child, I took the catechism with everyone else. I went to Mass, though I couldn't receive communion. And we never know quite what forms us in these matters. We have theology that says that the theological virtues are given us at baptism. Certainly, Anglican baptism is recognized in the Catholic Church. But I was a tender-hearted little boy. I was always a tender-hearted little boy. We had a terrible tragedy in our family. When I was in the second grade, my father wanted to go catfishing in irrigation ditches along the Rio Grande River. They were catching big catfish, and he wanted to go. He was eager. He had his mining engineer working for him, Ash Henderson, and he was going, and he was going to take the two older boys, my older brother, Richard, and he was going to take me. And my mother insisted that he take little Charlie, who was two and a half years old, something. And he finally agreed. What I can tell you is that while we were fishing, Charlie disappeared, and he wasn't found for 8 days. It's terrible. He was found finally trapped against a metal grating in one of those ditches, and he'd been there for 8 days. It changed my life profoundly. I couldn't stand hearing the word death. I turned inward. I became a bookworm. For 8 years, I hardly had friends. I read several books a week. I know, so it was some benefit in terms of my interior life that I was a bookworm. But I was extremely sensitive to people. It's been said that the sweetest boy is a 10-year-old boy. Somehow, that every mother knows this. When they're 10, they're really sweet. Anyhow, I was a sweet 10-year-old boy in New York City, suffering like hell because I found that inadvertently I was doing something that hurt someone, that took something from their dignity. And I never wanted to do that again, and I would rehearse how I would avoid that next time. And so I was always doing this business of making myself a better person, but never saying a word to anyone. But that's part of my story. The pastoral heart was there in me all that time. As I grew up, I thought of myself as an agnostic. I had no reason to believe that people could really know the answers that were claimed, the Christian truths, and I didn't really know quite what they were. But I began to have a social life in high school. I was in a theater group in high school at Forest Hills, and we had a very smart, fast-talking group of friends that put on really good theater productions, and I was in charge of the stage crew. The brother of our principal was the head of the Stagecraft Union, and according to union rules, a set couldn't be reused, so when a show closed down, sometimes a flatbed truck would show up, and we'd get all of these sets, and we would get to use them for our own purposes. And we had wonderful, we did great stuff. So I came alive socially during that time. And slowly I became softened. But it wasn't quick. When I was in college, I became very much enamored of Ayn Rand and the idea that, you know, I had some defensive armor, and I thought, well, I'll just keep my agreements, and I've taken care of you. Thank you very much, because I did what I said I would do, and I'm moving on. So I had that notion, and it served me well in my early career because I always performed. I was the only person in the conference room that knew what the right outcome of that meeting was, and when we got it done, it was over, and we were on our way. So I was very effective as a young manager, but I also was married, and I had children, and that works on you, doesn't it? I became softened up gradually over time. Well, the week, let's see, I was in my early 50s. Judy and I had an empty nest, and I became more interested in learning about what, after all, was my own tradition. I really wanted it. I wanted to know what's in Holy Scripture. I wanted to know what about the tradition. And it was, after all, mine, and I was so very ignorant. And I also wanted to be a part of some good countercultural presence in the community. So those were my two reasons. I let Judy choose the church, and she chose this beautiful wooden church that happened to be Trinity Episcopal Cathedral because it looked nice. And we walked in there half an hour early for a Sunday service because the Yellow Pages had the wrong time. So we were early, and we heard the choir rehearsing beautiful four-part anthems, Tudor anthems, and from the Anglican tradition. They say, you know, this is the kind of thing we like. They had a wonderful priest, the dean of the cathedral, Phil Gatchell, who gave these very intelligent sermons. Well, we heard the sermon, we went to coffee, and of course people notice you when you walk into church, and so people descended on us, and they said, why are you here? I said, we're looking for a church. They said, well, what's wrong with this one? I said, well, maybe you'll stay here. I said, well, maybe we will. I don't know. So at any rate, we did end up staying there. And after we'd been there a few Sundays, Dean Getchell at the announcement said, if any of you want to know more about the Anglican tradition, we'll be starting in an inquirer's class. Well, we were very interested. We want to know everything. So we went. And he started talking about the Book of Common Prayer. And I said, excuse me, Father, when was the first Book of Common Prayer written? He said, 1549. I said, how do I get a copy? He said, you have $10. I have them right here, right here. So I bought two cloth-bound Books of Common Prayer. And the Book of Common Prayer fell open to the most beautiful service for the reception of an adopted child into a family. It was so beautiful. And I discovered, starting right then, that this is a very beautiful thing, this Book of Common Prayer. And after we had gone, several weeks, we'd been going to this 45-minute inquirer's class, he said, you know, Bishop, the bishop will be here on Trinity Sunday, and I need to know who wants to be confirmed so we can get busy getting ready for that. And I said, well, when is Trinity Sunday? He said, June 6th. And that was 6 weeks off. I looked at the confirmation because I'd been baptized in the Church of England. I looked at the confirmation service, and I saw no way that I could make those declarations. There was no way that I could do that. But I had a decision to make, and I knew that I had to make the decision now. I could not put it off to later in my life. I had to decide. Somehow I knew that this was a point of decision. So I raided Barnes & Noble. I found C.S. Lewis this way. I found Mere Christianity. I found all. I was buying books and reading them. Judy and I committed to reading one gospel to the Dean Getchell. So I bought us each nice leather-bound Bibles, and I read the four gospels and Acts of the Apostles. I did this at night. Judy was sound asleep next to me, but I was crying. I hardly slept for 6 weeks. I was in a deep struggle because I was convinced, as a scientist for sure, that I would find these obstacles in my path that would then stop me cold and that I would be able to get back to my life. I was quite certain. I found them all vanish. I found them all being fictions and drifting, not being there at all, but vanishing in a strange way. As I held the Bible to read it, it was uncomfortable to hold. It felt electric in my hands. It was this odd business, that these words were written there for me. And if I had been present in those days, I would have written things in pretty much this way, that they were sufficiently consistent among themselves, there being no standards of journalism or historical writing in those days, that would have been pretty much like this. And so the question of the truth of this was quite open and not something that I could dismiss. And so, a week before Trinity Sunday was Pentecost, and Judy, having not been baptized, was prepared to be baptized that day. And on the way into church, because I had been baptized as an infant, I had never received communion. We had been going to Trinity Cathedral all this time without receiving communion. I said, Judy, after your baptism today, if you want to receive communion, I will be at your side. And we knelt at the altar rail. And Dean Getchell delivered us the wafers, and believe me, he noticed. And then at coffee afterwards, I said, Dean, I need to talk to you. He said, about what? Well, about whether I should be confirmed next Sunday when the bishop is here. He said, okay. He said, why don't you come on Tuesday? I have an opening in the afternoon. Well, it happened that Tuesday was the 1st of June. It was my 54th birthday. In those days, I was a businessman. I wore a suit and a necktie, and I shined my shoes every morning. And so I went in there and sat on his couch. And Dean Getchell was wearing a tweed jacket that day. He looked kind of like Bing Crosby in his collar and a tweed jacket. And he was in his desk chair, and he says, well, John, what can I do for you? Which, by the way, is the perfect pastoral question if you ever want to become a pastor. That's the question you ask. What can I do for you? And I said, Father, I want you, and I was looking at my shoes, I want you to know that if you're ready, I'm prepared to be confirmed on Sunday by the bishop. I have no reservations. I made this huge statement. Well, he had no idea what I had been going through. He knew only of my ignorance. He knew that I didn't know anything about scripture or tradition, that I had only been, I'd been going to this class and keeping my mouth shut because it was full of young people and I didn't want to dominate the thing with my questions. All my questions were being dealt with at home. And he sat back in his chair and he says, you know, John, there's something you don't know about me. He says, I'm a golf pro. On my days off, I teach golf. Well, it turns out he was one of the top players at Stanford in his day. He said, you know, I show people how to do it, and I can even reach around them and swing the club with them. He says, but after a while, they catch on, and they just catch on. He says, you know, the older I get, the less I feel that I can know a person's spiritual maturity, spiritual development. He says, so let's go ahead and confirm you, and sooner or later, you'll catch on. So that was his, and I, okay, all right. So come the day, and here I have to tell you things that are beyond human, for which I cannot be embarrassed. I have to simply tell you. I knelt before the bishop. I think I might have been the second or third in line. I knelt before him, folded my hands and put my head down and my chin against my fingers, and he laid his hands on my head. And there ensued a superhuman violence of his hands against my head in a very high-frequency, violent, you could call it a slapping motion, but the human muscles can't do this. And his voice was a very low drone, and there was some dilatation of time that I experienced because this drone went on and on and on. I couldn't make out a thing he said, and I was profoundly comfortable. At some point then, finally, his voice stopped, and I was unable to move. He then, with a knuckle of his right hand, raised up my chin, and I was very embarrassed because my eyes were closed, And with great effort, I forced my eyes open, and I realized that my eyes were rolled back into my head, and I was showing the poor man the whites of my eyes. I was very embarrassed by this, and with great effort, I rolled my eyes down to where I was looking toward him, but I still couldn't see him because my eyes were focused at infinity. But finally, with great effort, I drew him into focus, and I saw him smiling at me in a most kindly way, and I did my best to respond to smile back with my eyes. Then I was unable to stand, and I was helped to my feet by a senior priest who was nearby, a canon of the church. He helped me to my feet, and I stood behind the altar rail. After all were confirmed and standing behind the altar rail, the bishop stood off to the side, and in a kindly way, he said, "Oh, this is a fine group of confirmands we have here." He says, "I see a priest or two here, and maybe even a bishop." When he said the word priest, there was an explosion in my chest. It was an earthquake of acknowledgement, and I knew in that instant that my whole life now made sense, that everything from this moment forward in my life was to comfort and bring hope to others, and that this was far beyond any capacity of mine to deny. We then went to the pews for the liturgy of the Eucharist, and on the way there I felt strangely graceful in my movements, as if I couldn't make an awkward movement if I tried. My chest was strangely inflated in a way that was very odd, but it persisted for several weeks. After the Mass, I went over to the choir to ask a woman there who had sponsored me for confirmation, an older woman who was a professor of chemistry, if she would join us for brunch. And someone beside her, a soprano in the choir, who was the wife of this senior canon of the cathedral, she'd had her whole life in the church, looked at me and she said, "Well, John, it seems that you will be turning your collar around." I was absolutely stunned that she knew this thing that had happened to me, and I couldn't say anything at all. 2 years went by before I'd been in seminary already for a year before I dared to ask her what she meant by that. But it had been a great comfort to me that she said that. And she said, "John, when you knelt before the bishop, the air was filled with electricity, and it was clear to me that you were to be a priest." She gave no more detail than that. And so finally, when I was in seminary and I went first to see my spiritual director, the prior of Incarnation Prior, a senior priest with a fringe of white hair. This were the monks who tended to seminarians there in Berkeley. I went to see him for the first time and I said, "Father, I have one question for you. Am I crazy?" I started telling him about this. And he said, "John, first of all, you're not crazy. Secondly, have you written this down?" I said, "No, I don't want to write it down. I don't want people to think I'm crazy." He said, "John, write it down." So a formative experience in my first semester in seminary was to write these two long single-spaced letters to this holy man, confessing in clinical detail my experience of call to the priesthood. I'm so grateful to that man. He served as my spiritual director for 6 years. At any rate, I now was on my way to becoming an Episcopal priest. And not knowing why, I had no idea on earth why I would have been called. This was not something I had anticipated. I was only certain of my ignorance. I had no preparation. It was not my idea. I spent the summer very miserably trying to make sense of this, of creating hypotheses, none of which held up. The only thing that made sense was that a will other than my own was at work in my life, that I had a choice of responding or not. I wrote a letter. Oh, no. to give you some more details. I had the next day after this happened, I took a plane to Albuquerque and I was attending a classified meeting on strategic missile defense. And I was so preoccupied at breakfast, the waitress was concerned for me because I stared at the floor and I didn't eat my breakfast. Are you all right? I had this, I'm going to be a priest now. And how can you think about ordinary things? So I went into this meeting, this big hall, and the security guards and all of the classified meeting, and I couldn't stay. I got up and ran out, went into my hotel room, closed the door, and sat on the edge of my bed and burst into tears with racking sobs and made three promises to God, which I knew were being asked of me. That my mother, who was in stage 3 Alzheimer's, could come home and live with us. That my little brother, who died at 2 years old, would never be forgotten, and that I would follow where this leads. Those exact words. It happens that my little brother was buried in a cemetery there in Albuquerque, and I found his grave, brushed off his little red granite stone, and knelt there. And it happened again that I burst into tears and made the same three promises to God. Just the same. Somehow I got through the week. I had a meeting. The meeting ended on Thursday afternoon, but I had to go up to Los Alamos because the laboratory owed us a whole bunch of money and had for 2 years not returned our phone calls and was not about to pay us this money. They owed us, a very prestigious government laboratory that makes nuclear weapons, owed us money. So they accepted an appointment from me at 2 in the afternoon on Friday, which already tells you they didn't want to see me. So I was in this little town of, I think it's called Española, on the Rio Grande, on this, this was the 11th of June, a beautiful sunny spring day. I had breakfast, I was in a business suit, and I sat at a picnic table in this flea bag motel and opened the Bible to what came next, which is, of course, Romans. And I had no idea this is Paul's Summa Theologica. It's there because it's the longest of his epistles, but it was the next one. And I started reading this with a sense of such clarity, again, as though every word was written for me. And so I went to my meeting at this big laboratory, and it was in the head shed, the headquarters, and they had this conference room with this table that was as long as a football field, and they sat me at one head, at the head of it. The rest of them didn't sit down because they were too nervous. They all stood and I sat in this big conference room, and they had time to research this thing, and they had figured out that the reason they hadn't paid us and the reason this guy had not returned our phone calls is that he had prematurely closed out their contract with the government before he collected all his costs. He had not collected our last invoice at the time he made his claim for final payment from the government. So they realized this, and I had with me this long thermofax of the phone record, and it was very long things. It was 2 years worth of attempted phone calls, and they said, may we have a copy of that? And I said, no, I don't want to embarrass you. I was being so nice in my state, I didn't want to give anybody a problem. I was this nice guy. I'd never been in a meeting like that in my life. Finally, I let them make a copy of it, and they said, no. Oh, they said, you know, we do, they're talking to each other in my presence. We do have a source of payment. There's laboratory director's funds, and we can use some of that to pay this. They're in my presence. And they looked at me, then they stopped, and they said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm the president of this little company. I said, I'm going to go back to my office and I'm going to write you what's called a demand letter, demanding payment. This was the 11th of June. By the 1st of July, if I receive it by then, that will close the issue. If not, we will add interest and collection costs. I will turn it over to a lawyer. And they said, oh, thank you. They were so grateful. I sent the letter and they sent the money. And I had never been in a meeting like that in my life. So, I'm in the state of grace doing business. So the next day I'm home and Judy doesn't know anything about this, my wife. So she's having coffee. She has the dogs on her lap. She's doing a crossword puzzle. She's sitting in the sunroom, cup of coffee. And I'm standing in the doorway, and how the heck do I tell her that I'm not going to be a priest? I started trying to choke it out, and Judy was trying to make sense of what I'm saying. She said, well, Oh, the bishop was talking about those young kids, not about you. And I said, you don't understand. And finally she stopped and she said, John, the Holy Spirit has you by the throat. You're going to be a priest. From that moment, she completely accepted this. I don't know how I could have such a wife as this, but that was the way it was. And then I had to talk to the poor priest now, Dean Getchell. So at Sunday, I said, Dean, I have to talk to you about something. He says, well, again, I have time on Tuesday again. Come on Tuesday. So I come on Tuesday and went, what the heck do I tell this priest? I had rehearsed so carefully with exact words I would tell him, and I polished my shoes again. So he sat in his chair. I sat on the couch looking at my shoes, and I had these carefully rehearsed words. Father, I said, after the confirmations, was I dreaming, or did the bishop address me directly and say with conviction that I should be a priest? He said, a priest? And he about fell over. I didn't know anything. He said, how miserable I was. He said, John, you've got to talk to the bishop. I said, no, I don't want to talk. I've only saw him once. I don't want to talk to the bishop. I didn't know that this is the first canonical step toward ordination. The priest brings you to the bishop. I said, no, maybe you could talk to him. Could you ask him if he meant it? You know, he said, no, you have to talk to the bishop. So then he sent me a little note a few days later. John, I spoke to the bishop. It turns out that he will see you, but I'm going to be on vacation the month of July. So apparently I was to cool off the month of July. And so we'll see it when I'm back from vacation. Well, the bishop was on vacation during August. So I was stewing in my juices this summer, this in this terrible state. In August, I took a week in Montana fishing with my sons, one of my two brothers, and all of the nephews, all these Huntington men catching significant trout in the Beaverhead River and in the Big Hole River, and camping and frying up a lot of bacon and eggs and just having a great time. And you see pictures of that, and you see this big, miserable man in this beautiful environment suffering over this question of this call and this unresolved thing. And so I was observing my behavior, and I was in misery because I found my behavior so completely unacceptable, that my rough sense of humor was hurting people, that I was taking little nicks out of people's dignity with the way I poked fun with my humor, and especially I was injuring my three sons. It was awful. It was so clear that this person could never be such a good person as a priest would have to be. It was just out of the question. And I lay awake in the tent at maybe 2 a.m. one night, looking at the ceiling of the tent, and finally I said, John, those changes need to be made anyhow. You can't use this as an excuse. You can't do that. You have to go forward. And so by the end of August, I had resolved. This was a terrible struggle of 10 weeks or so. On the 1st of September, I'm normally found in a ditch somewhere hunting doves with my buddy, right? So he called me the day before on a Tuesday, and he says, John, let's go down to Coalinga, and we'll hunt doves tomorrow. And I said, no, I don't think so. I think I'll hang around. I don't know why I said that. But about 11 in the morning, I get a phone call from Dean Getchell. He says, Wednesdays are the bishop's office days here at the cathedral, and he's back from vacation, and he's here. Would you like to talk to him? By now, I really was ready. Yeah, I wanted to talk to him. So I said, well, come on over. And I came over 15 minutes early for my appointment, and I sat in the library. And the dean walked by, and he says, oh, John, you're here. Let me see where the bishop is. Well, he was around the corner in a coffee shop. He says, let's go. Let's go find him. So here I am walking across a parking lot with the dean of the cathedral looking for the bishop to talk about priesthood. In a really odd circumstance, and we get to Laurel's Delights, which is the name of this coffee shop. We look in the plate glass window, and there's the bishop talking with some woman, and we walk in, and they were just finished with their coffee, and she leaves, and he says, you know, I could use another espresso. Let's sit right here. I said, what, here? Is there a public can talk here? He said, yeah, over here, this table by the plate glass window will be fine. So he sat there. The dean sat here, and I sat there. So here I am with the Bishop of El Camino Real, the Dean of Trinity Cathedral, and I'm sitting there to talk about priesthood. The dean gets me a double mocha. He gets a decaf something or other, and the bishop gets another espresso. So I drank my double mocha, and thus caffeinated, I spoke for an hour. Every word was perfect. I spoke exactly what was on my heart. I spoke for an hour, it poured out of me. And the bishop sat there with his head tilted and with a little smile, and every once in a while he would ask a clarifying question. And what I was telling him was that I thought, you know, my particular background may be a help to people. I come from a scientific background. Maybe I can help them with their faith. But he says, I hear apologetics. And I thought, well, that wasn't quite it. If you read my column in the Herald, you know what it is, by the way. That was not quite it. But then he did something that absolutely astonished me. He looked at me, and if I cry, you'll understand why. He said, John, effective today, I'm placing you in the process for ordination. I will send you a letter to this effect tomorrow. Dean, give him something to do. Give him a project. Get him busy. I couldn't believe it. He says, John, have your papers in by the first Sunday of Advent. And so I started getting very busy with my psychological evaluation, criminal background check, and filling out all kinds of stuff and getting all of that done. He said, John, you must find a suitable spiritual director immediately. And I looked in the rule, the ordination book, it says that the spiritual director has to be approved by the bishop. So I chose this one very intellectual canon of the cathedral, Douglas Williams, whose wife it was that recognized my call. And I asked him, it was a noon mass during a weekday, and I stood up. There were just the two of us in the church. And I started to cry. I said, Father, will you be my spiritual director? Will you help me? I said, I don't know what I'm doing. And I was crying. And he started laughing. He says, you know, I can't promise that it will work at all, will be any effective or any good at all, but I will do my best for you, yes. I said, I have to find out if the bishop will approve of you. He says, oh, I think the bishop will approve of me. Don't worry. He was the dean. He was an examining chaplain of the diocese, so I think he would accept him. Well, that's far enough. The thing is that I want to tell you the one more thing, which is the question about why on earth I might have been called to be a priest. This is getting a bit long, but it's very important in the discernment of the vocation. When I was a transitional deacon, we were vacationing in England. We have a son there who's a professor at Cambridge University. And anyhow, we were driving up to go to Edinburgh, Scotland, and I had this real urgent desire to stop at Durham Cathedral. It was urgent. I had a particular feeling about St. Cuthbert. If you know anything about Cuthbert of Lindisfarne, this wonderful saint is really famous for his simple piety. He was a simple monk on the island of Lindisfarne. He wanted even to be away from the monks and to be a hermit, and he got some permission to do that. People knelt in the snow on this little island outside his little cell until he agreed to become their bishop. So he was a bishop, and a very famous story told about his work and how it is that he finally asked to be excused so he could go back to his hermitage. But there's stories about him. There's the Venerable Bede's Life of Cuthbert is a wonderful book. So this is the man I wanted to consult. And I went to Durham Cathedral because his remains are buried underneath the altar there. They were saved during the during the English Reformation. His remains were spirited away and they were not destroyed. You know, many of the bones of the saints were fired from cannons in those days and dispersed. But there was Cuthbert, and I knelt at his tomb with a question: why on earth, if this was not my idea, if a will other than my own, if it was God's will that I be called in this unquestionable fashion, there has to be some purpose that at some point must become clear to me. It isn't, I'm a deacon now, I'll be a priest soon, I have no idea why this has all happened, but I've said yes, and yes, and yes, and here I am. And now I cannot tell you just how this came about, because it's not one of those things that said, but there was a moment of recognition that it was Cuthbert that somehow said, this is the saint or the person that gives you your true vocation. But it evolved over time that I was to be with Saint Ignatius among the people. And so I can tell you at length about my work in California. I was made the canon missioner to Silicon Valley for my diocese. I was out with the people as a priest. And I'm very, very close to the Society of Jesus. I've had a number of spiritual directors who were Jesuits. All three of the Catholic priests who recommended me for ordination as a Catholic priest were Jesuits. Father, if you happen to know Father Vincent Hovley here at the Sacred Heart Jesuit Retreat House, is a dear friend of mine. He was my spiritual director for 4 years. I served as a senior fellow in the Woodstock Jesuit Theological Center at Georgetown University, and every time I saw the likeness of St. Ignatius, I was so happy. There's a wonderful statue of him there, and it's at Santa Clara University, where I taught in the Religious Studies Department. There's a beautiful picture of Ignatius in the chapel and all of this. So I'm a natural Jesuit, that is, a Jesuit by nature, and I'm very, very close to the Society of Jesus. So let me get on then. What time is it now? It is, okay, let's see if I can wrap this up rather quickly then. Let me tell you quickly about what I did to reconcile my two vocations, because as you can see, there was nothing trivial but something very deep about both of them. And it would be horrible if they were in conflict in some way, because both of them deeply were who I was. I mean, I was a priest and a scientist to the soles of my feet, and there was all of this nonsense going on about faith and science, which was not part of my experience, and I didn't know quite how to make sense of all of this. But I started making good progress when I was in seminary. And I can tell you that there was a decisive moment, because I have to start with the question of what physical science actually is. If I'm a physical scientist, I ought to know what physical science is, and I ought to be able to articulate it to myself and to anybody who's interested. What is physical science? And it became clear to me that physical science is empirical. It's the body of knowledge that's based upon observations made with the instruments of observation that physical scientists use. Philosophically, when it comes to how this all works, I join with Aristotle and Aquinas by treating the instruments of physical science as extensions of our natural senses that allow us to see things that our natural senses can't see. So there's that question of what physical science actually is. And then, okay, that worked for me. And so you can see that my study of quantum mechanics is this very, very objective, true insight into the fundamental processes of physical processes. It is also a self-consistent theory of knowledge about the physical world, quantum mechanics. At any rate, how then does this connect with spiritual matters? I am in my first semester in seminary, in my apartment, studying crazy hours and staring at the bricks and trying to make sense of this as well. And so let me make you a little diagram of what I worked out, because I want it to be a help to you as well. I gave myself permission to define mathematics as a human language. Clearly, much of it is an invention. It's been invented because it was interesting or useful in some way. But it also allows us to do quantitative work because we can use mathematics to describe structures and relationships, which is really what mathematics does. And it's inherently quantitative. And therefore, if we take mathematics as a human language, add it to all the other human languages, then it's possible to say that all of physical science can be completely expressed in human language. Why? Because the instruments that make the measurements were built by the physicists who made drawings of them and built them. They can describe everything about the instruments, and the data set that's obtained by these observations can be described in terms of all quantities. If you're looking at the sky, you have time-dependent spectral information of all quantities and so on. So it's easy to, if you talk about vision, our vision actually is pixelized. We have rods and cones, and the apparent continuity of what we see is a post-processing that's done back here. But all of these things, it turns out, can be, with arbitrary accuracy, treated as quantities. So I said for myself, well, physical science deals only with quantities. That was new to me because I never had to think of it that way before. So all true statements that are, this is now physical science. Physical science here. All statements that are true, that are contained within the bounds of physical science, can be described in human language. Now, human language is not limited to that, because we have many things that are not quantitative in nature that we have where language works perfectly well. We can discuss questions of meaning, value, and purpose that are not quantifiable, and that can be dealt with to some degree by language. And so the scope of language is greater than that of physical science. This is language. And the question then is language adequate to describe everything that can be grasped by the human mind? And the answer is, well, no. That's why we have poetry and music. We have many things that for which language is not adequate. And so if we have then the human mind can grasp whatever we use language for, but it can grasp more, and this is why we have poetry and other things. So this is what the human mind can grasp, this is what language can describe, and this is physical science, which is quantities only. And the question then is there something out here? Is there more than the human mind can grasp? And I've never found anyone yet to say, no, this is void out here. So we admit easily when we think this way, it's comfortable for us to acknowledge that the human mind can only grasp some of the things that are true, that questions of meaning, value, and purpose fall outside of the competence of physical science. And so we can immediately define how transcendence operates. It cuts across these boundaries. And that's what it is to be a human being, which is why science and faith are inherently free of conflict. Physical science cannot challenge faith. There's more to say on that subject, but this was a big step for me. And what I found in surrendering to it, a supernatural call to becoming ordained a priest, to having the privilege of sitting up with the dying, all of the things that the priest experiences in the hospitals and all of that, given to me as a gift, making sense to me now at last. Along the way, I must say, I learned a great deal about patience. I learned so much in seminary and in my voracious reading that began immediately in the spring of 93, I love my library, that the tradition that I wanted to possess when I began all of this had possessed me. I was owned by the tradition, which is profoundly comforting, because I learned in my third year of seminary, when I finally was able to process what had happened to me, that Trinity Sunday, with very good theological help, that I had been drawn into the tradition that I shared with so many others, this deep experience of the faith. I had lost any ability to deny God. It had been taken from me. So I give my witness to the world at peace. Now, I should tell you about my reconciliation with Rome, and I'll try to do this very quickly. It's always fair to ask a Protestant what he's protesting these days. You know, is you're a Protestant? Well, is it the Protestant complaints of the 16th century? And if so, which of them would you choose today? Because there were a lot of them, and which ones do you choose? Or what is it that is it something else that's happened recently that's offended you? And what is it? And so the thing that I am sorry to tell you is that this question doesn't mean much to most Protestants. Most Protestants do not simply define themselves in relation to the Catholic Church that they're supposedly protesting against. They just don't. And so for those of us who struggled with this, we found ourselves in a very small minority. I was deeply, deeply invested in ARCIC, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, and the great work that was done after the Second Vatican Council toward reconciliation between Anglicanism and the Roman Catholic Church. I had the example of John J. Hughes, a Catholic priest who is an Episcopal priest, who found that when he did research, that the bishops who had ordained him deacon and priest were in fact in a line of apostolic succession. He found that, researched it, and with the help of a senior Franciscan abbot in Rome, asked the Vatican, are my orders effective? Are they valid? And they checked his research and said, your research is correct. The bishops who ordained you were in the apostolic succession, but we cannot say that your orders are valid, because there are questions of form and intention as well, and we're not really quite sure. Just to be sure, you should be conditionally ordained. And he showed this letter to, he was in I think it was Münster in Germany, getting his PhD, and he showed the Catholic bishop this letter, and he says, well, then I must ordain you. And he ordained him through all seven orders in an afternoon. And there he was, standing a Catholic priest in an afternoon. He was a Catholic priest. And he is still alive today, John J. Hughes. He is retired in St. Louis, and I've met him. He's written some wonderful books. He's a church historian. But I was hoping, well, how about on a case-by-case basis, those of us who are Anglo-Catholic could be conditionally ordained. What do you know about the Episcopal Church will tell you what happened. So few of us cared about our relationship with the Catholic Church that we were simply pushed aside by people that had other agendas. And so I could tell you about the Elizabethan settlement and all of that stuff. But suffice it to say that in the polity of the Church of England and of the Episcopal Church, lay people have control of doctrine and discipline. The bishops do not have the authority to control doctrine and discipline. And heretical bishops have been tolerated, and I can name a couple of them for you. In other words, if you wanted refuge from that, you must become Catholic. The Anglicans have always avoided a magisterium from the beginning, from the Elizabethan settlement. So just the long and short of this is that I suffered with this very much, that I inquired about different ways that I might become a Catholic priest. It didn't work out for me, and was in Maryland when I was assisting a parish there and decided we simply have to become Catholic, and I was exploring how I might do that. When Pope Benedict XVI issued his apostolic constitution, Anglicanorum Chaetibus, We knew it was coming. By that time, we had already joined Mount Calvary Church in Baltimore, and along with all of the parishioners and four priests, including me, and the church property, we all became Catholic on the 22nd of January of last year. I can't tell you what that morning was like. It was so wonderful for all of us. We had two orders of nuns present in their habits. We had all kinds of dignitaries, a full church and incense and gorgeous music. And we all made our vows, and we were received and confirmed in the Catholic Church by Monsignor Jeffrey Steenson, the ordinary of the or the personal ordinariate of the chair of St. Peter. And so we really are one now. I thank God for that. Thank you. I have no idea how much time is left. I suppose there's some questions. Do we? Do we have some on already written down on paper? There's someone with his hand up.
Thank you very much for your talk. There are some very interesting coincidences. Jeffrey Steenson is one of my friends from my early interest in the Catholic Church. I too am a convert, or an entrant into the church from Episcopalianism. Also, Stewards of the Lord was a formative book for me. John J. Hughes' Stewards of the Lord, and so I very much appreciate your going through and expressing all the stages of your journey to Rome, because for me personally, there are so many points of similarity, and just these two instances I was astounded when you mentioned that Jeffrey Steenson was the one who had accepted you into the church. We've had correspondence over the years, and we also share the interesting fact that both he and I have autistic sons. So, anyway, thank you again very much.
Are there other questions or comments? I think, did I blow you away? There's a card. Let's see what this has. let me see. I'm going to put on my glasses here. How and why did you become drawn into the Roman Catholic Church? And what is my role and position in the Roman Catholic Church? I became drawn farther back than I can remember. I was very much affected by my time at Mount Carmel School in Socorro, New Mexico. I adored the sisters. I took everything seriously there. I've never found the idea of Protestantism a long-term proposition. The separation was always meant to be temporary. So there's that. And then when all of the reasons which are recently manufactured for staying away from Rome didn't touch me, none of them were my own reasons, you see. And I started analyzing what really was going on, what I was experiencing around me. And I decided to retire. I was the rector of St. Andrew's Church in Cripple Creek, and I decided I couldn't stay anymore. I had attended the 2006 General Convention of the Episcopal Church in Columbus, and I saw what happened there, and I lost all hope that the Anglican Communion could ever restore discipline. I lost hope. I wrote a journal of that convention, and I sent it around the country and around the world to people. This is what I saw. I was attending all of the right meetings where things were discussed, and I saw there was no hope, that the church had been seized by a faction who was strictly permissive and wanted to do things that they wanted to do, and if they wanted to reinvent the church every day when they woke up, they wanted to do that, and I just could no longer be part of that. So that then freed me to go to Rome. So it was very hard because of my institutional loyalties and all of my friendships to turn away. It was very hard, very painful. But the good thing I was turning toward was so very positive. Right now, you asked what is my role and position in the Catholic Church. My canonical status is candidate for Catholic holy orders. I've completed everything required for ordination for the personal ordinariate of the Chair of St. Peter. Unfortunately, just as I was about to ask when this ordination would happen, new direction was received from the Vatican that no more ordinations would be approved unless this candidate was bringing with him an existing Anglican congregation that wanted to become Roman. Well, I had done that in Baltimore, but they sent me here to receive Episcopalians into the Catholic Church in Colorado, and then found that they could not move my candidacy forward. So that sits there. It may be carved on my tombstone, candidate for Catholic holy orders. In the meantime, Bishop Sheridan has been very kind to me. Father Gregory is very, very hospitable. I'm a part of things here now. I've been invited to write for the diocesan paper. It's a big thing for me to get to do that. And I am the director of adult formation for St. Peter Parish. So I have suitable work, and I find it quite comforting and very good that I get to do these things.
John, I have a question. You said that you just went to a church because it was pretty to go into it at Trinity Cathedral. Do you think that if you had gone into a Catholic church at that same time, you would have had the same experience? Why did you not seek out Catholicism?
I let Judy choose. I said, you go ahead, pick the denomination. She said, go look in the yellow pages, pick the church. And then with the music that we heard was a surprise to us. It was beautiful four-part stuff. So that was it. The likelihood that we would hear music like that in a Catholic church is rather small, I'm sorry to say.
Amen.
I think we can do something about that also. I think we can always make beautiful music.
But again, to the question of, it sounds like you went to Catholicism because of sort of an abdication of the Anglican Church, as opposed to being consistent with your search for truth. As you were going through seminary, did you run into questions that made you think, maybe the truth that I'm looking to here, there's something beyond this?
I will now blow you away with some information. The Catechism of the Catholic Church was published in English in 1994, the year I entered seminary. I immediately bought a copy and kept it right by my elbow all the way through seminary, and it kept me sane.
You know that Father Larry told us that we didn't have to memorize the catechism in our formation, but it would help.
Maybe the little Baltimore catechism, but not the big one. As a scientist, have you ever questioned the existence of God? How do you answer someone like Stephen Hawking, who says there is no God? Well, I'm sorry to use argumentum ad hominem, but I don't think Stephen Hawking knows what he's talking about. He's way off the reservation, and he has nothing in his discipline would give him any insight into these questions. The same thing goes for Richard Feynman. I admire Feynman very much. I don't think much of Hawking at all. Have I questioned the existence of God? I don't have the capacity to do that since that day, Trinity Sunday of 1993. I do not have the capacity to objectively examine the question of God's existence. I am a person of faith in the particular sense. I've been completely ruined for rational discourse on the existence of God. I am simply a witness. Thank you very much. I have a prayer, a final prayer then. Do you have something to add?
Yeah, I was just going to say, are there any more questions? We're good. Would you stay for a little while after we're finished in case someone has a personal question?
Of course. Also, I'm at St. Peter's and I can be found there if you want to talk. My telephone number is published.
Yeah. So thank you, John, for your sharing your beautiful pilgrimage to the church. And the RCI candidates are richly blessed to have you.
Thank you.
Nation, okay?
The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
Almighty and ever-living God, ruler of all things in heaven and earth, hear our prayers for this parish family of St. Peter. Strengthen the faithful. Arouse the careless and restore the penitent. Grant us all things necessary for our common life. And bring us all to be of one heart and mind within your holy church. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.